This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello, and welcome to episode 180. I'm Chris Stafford, and on this week's episode, we're going to be hearing from USEF Senior Dressage Judge and L Faculty Member Marilyn Heath to talk about why you should expect different scores from judges sitting at different positions. Charlotte Trentleman will be here to explain the USDF Service Awards, and finally, Dr. Laura Werner shares the most up-to-date treatments for kissing spine. But we begin with the headline news from the weekend of the Longines FEI World Cup Dressage Finals that took place in Paris, France, where Laura Graves got off to a great start, winning the Grand Prix, scoring a personal best of 81.413 with the 16-year-old KWPN gelding Verdadis that she co-owns with Kurt Mayas. The other US rider, Shelley Francis from Loxahatchee, Florida, and Danilo, Patricia Stemple's 14-year-old Hanoverian gelding, finished the Grand Prix with a score of 68.23%, putting them in 17th place. But the tables were to turn for Laura Graves when it came to the freestyle on Saturday afternoon, where the defending champion, Germany's Isabel Werth, took the title with a score of 90.657. Laura Graves finished runner-up with a score of 89.082%, with Jessica von Bredow-Werndl, also from Germany, scoring 83.725%. And this result makes it the fourth World Cup title for Germany's Isabel Werth. And, of course, a back-to-back winner with Viagold. And now to our first segment this week, where I'm joined by USEF Senior Dressage Judge and L Faculty Member Marilyn Heath, who will explain why it's important to have judges in different positions around the arena and why their scores are likely to be different. Well, Marilyn, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
We are going to be talking about the judges' perspective this time. The different angles, of course, and views from the different boxes. So where would you like to start on this, Marilyn?
Well, I just like to mention that it's riders often do question why scores from judges at different vantage points around the arena have different scores, and they shouldn't be vastly different, but there are different things that are seen from the different vantage points, and so they're not always judging the same thing, so the scores are going to be different. I can point out, for instance, that if the judge at C is judging a center line, an entrance, and the horse comes down the center line and is absolutely straight and halts in balance and moves off with activity, that judge is going to give a very high score. The judge on the side, however, may see that the halt was not square and it was not at X, and the judge on the side, therefore, will not have as high a score. In judge education, we often find that the judges on the side, as most judge education programs are held on the side, because there are 10 candidates, 10 scribes, one examiner, a scribe for the examiner, so that's 22 people, and then the organizer and maybe a couple of scorers, and so it's a big crowd. And it's very difficult to find a facility that will accommodate that many people along the short end of the arena. Therefore, judge education programs end up on the side where they will be less of an obstruction for the riders, have less of an impact. So people involved in judge education usually are on the side, and it's unfortunate if they try to mimic the judge at sea, try to guess what the judge at sea is seeing, and come up with and try to mirror the score of the judge at sea. So on getting back to our center line, if the horse comes down the center line and is not on the center line or is weaving on the center line, the judge at sea is going to lower her score. But this particular horse then halts right at X and halts square, and the weaving on the center line is barely visible from the side, and so the judge on the side is going to have a higher score. So it works both ways. Another example of that would be the lateral work, all of the lateral work, starting with leg yield. We often have people from the side, novice judges, saying haunches trail. And that's really the responsibility of the judge at sea. But that's what they expect they should be saying, instead of judging what they can see from the side, which is they can see whether the basics are affected by the leg yield. Does the rhythm remain the same? Does the horse remain on the bit? Does the tempo slow? So it's the responsibility of the judge on the side to judge those things, the things that they can see better than the judge at sea. And it's the responsibility of the judge at sea to judge the things that they can see from sea better than the judge on the side. So scores are going to be different. The same is true of shoulder in. The judge at sea is in a much better position to judge the angle and the bend, and the judge on the side is in a better position to judge the quality of the trot, the maintaining a consistent tempo, the length of the steps. And the same is true of travers and half pass and all the other lateral work. Then you get to the lengthenings, mediums, and extendeds, and the judge on the side has an advantage because the judge on the side can see the balance of the horse, can see the length of the stride, can see the length of the lengthening and shortening of the frame, and the judge at sea can see better whether the horse is wide behind. Therefore, does the horse remain engaged? So judges are taught to judge what they can see from where they're sitting, not to try to second guess the judge at sea. Each judge is responsible for judging what they can judge from where they are, and each judge judges independently of the other judge. And yes, it's good if the scores agree in principle, but there are going to be differences. One rider will say, I've heard a rider walking away from the secretary's office with her test, and she says, well, she gave me an 8, and the judge on the side gave me a 5. Well, that's what it looked like from those different places. It's not that they have different standards. All judges have the same standards, and all judges have the welfare of the horse in mind. All judges are responsible for evaluating each movement of the test according to the standard. Judges are also aware of the meaning of the marks that they give. So in that case of an 8 and a 5, 8 is good and 5 is marginal. Well, something happened that made the judge on the side give that 5, knowing that the score was a marginal score, whereas from the front it looked good. I just also like to add that judges have the welfare of the horse and the good of the rider in mind, and that judges like to give high scores. Judges never like to give low scores. I've also heard people at scoreboards saying, look at these scores. Well, judges sit there all day and watch every single ride, and riders don't. So riders go to the scoreboard and see low scores, but they haven't seen all the rides. So they should consider that if the scores are low, perhaps the standards were not being met. Also, riders have responsibilities, and riders should read the rule book They need to understand the criteria of each movement. They need to understand the purpose of each level. That is written on the top of each test, and it's also in the rule book. And they need to know what the directives are for each movement as written on each test in each movement. And then they will perhaps better understand where the scores come from. Or better yet, they could audit the L program, and that gives riders a huge insight into how judges think and what they're looking for.
Very helpful overview there, Marilyn. Thank you very much indeed. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, I can't emphasize enough judges liking to give good scores, but judges have to see good rides to give good scores.
All right. That's a good takeaway. Well, Marilyn, again, thank you very much for coming on the program. Always good to catch up with you. Appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
And our next guest is Charlotte Trentleman, who is chair of the U.S. Dressage Federation's Historical Recognition Committee. And Charlotte will walk us through the USDF Service Awards and how you can nominate a deserving person in each of the categories. Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're going to talk about some of the principal awards, aren't we, today? Because there are three very distinguished awards that the USDF awards each year at the annual convention. So let's just outline those. So the Hall of Fame one, and that, I understand, is the only one in which a horse can be nominated as well. So that is one we'll talk about, and the Lifetime Achievement, and then also the Member of Distinction. So where would you like to begin?
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning. 22 years ago in 1996, was that 22? Yep. We gave the first Hall of Fame award to our past president, Lowell Boomer. And we established the Hall of Fame because we wanted people to understand where we came from, who actually impacted us the most. And the Hall of Fame is really to demonstrate we're looking for people and horses that have demonstrated a longevity of excellence in the sport of dressage and that made an outstanding contribution to the growth and our development, our quality, and the popularity and appreciation from spectators in dressage also, which is why we brought in the horses too. They were much, much needed, I think. Our first horse that we instituted in 1997 was Gifted, and also at the same year we did Keen. So those are two that really were keystones in getting public interest in our sport and bringing us into the limelight a little bit. These people are what we call rock stars. They are people that have, in the sport of dressage and in other sports of horses, they really, you know, have some notability, in other words, even if you're not just in dressage. Whereas opposed to that, the Lifetime Achievement, I think, is more important because that recognizes long and faithful volunteer service to USDF itself. That's why we can have some people who, in the Hall of Fame, never belonged to USDF. Obviously, the horses did not belong to USDF. But for Lifetime Achievement, we are looking for people who have impacted and helped the United States Dressage Federation over a long period of years and may have actually done many different things. Been an executive board member, then president, vice president, treasurer, secretary, might have led a committee, might have, well, we have Marilyn Heath, who was the cornerstone of the L program. She's in there. You know, there are lots of people that really helped in that division. Those people are really the backbone of USDF. Our members of distinction, we realized a while back that there were a lot of people that were being nominated, but they only really had impact on a certain area or region of USDF. The member of distinction demonstrates exceptional commitment to his or her local area or region, carrying out the USDF mission, which of course is a dedication to education and the recognition of achievement in the promotion of dressage. So we found that there were a lot of people that were being nominated that didn't exactly meet the requirements of being broad over the United States for the USDF. So we established the member distinction, and that has been going on for the last 2 years. And we're very happy with that. We've gotten a lot of interest in it, a lot of nominations, but we're still looking for more. We need to find the people that need to be recognized.
So let's talk a little bit about the process of nomination and how you can go about that as a member and the timeline and that sort of thing.
Okay. Our nominations for each year are due by May 1st. So now is a very good time for someone to go on our website, usdf.org, click on the Hall of Fame. It will come up with the nomination forms. And if you think you know someone who you would like to nominate for Hall of Fame or Lifetime Achievement or Member of Distinction, just go ahead and download the nomination form. It doesn't matter which nomination form you really use. And let me explain that. We find sometimes that people think, oh, this person was so good for us. She impacted a lot of people. She should be in the Hall of Fame. She, you know, worked for years and years and years. So they put the application out for Hall of Fame. But when we look at it as a committee, we see that, oh, this person really, because of the longevity and the promotion of the sport and education, you know, perhaps they should be in the Lifetime Achievement. So we have the ability to go ahead and move them from one set to the next. So if you apply or nominate someone and it's not quite the right fit, we usually go back to the person who nominates and says, you know, we think this person would fit in well in this situation. Do you mind if we moved it? So, and we can do that. Also, I wouldn't be afraid to nominate someone even if you did not know everything about them. If you think, well, this person was in our area for so many years and they came across the country, they must have done this and that, but I don't know what they've done, you can fill out just as much as you can on the nomination and send it into USDF. We do have archives, and we do have people in the office that will go through, take a look, see what they can find from the about this person that you may or may not have known, even though you nominated them. And we fill in the blanks. They fill in the blanks and they hand it back to the committee for inspection. And we go from there. So you don't have to know everything about the person. And if you're confused about which category to put them in, that's not the problem. We need to get people to send us their ideas and remembrances of people that they thought were really important to the sport.
And can a member nominate more than one person in these categories at all, Charlotte?
Yes, definitely. And we do get a lot of nominations from time to time, and we need to fill them out. We need to go through the archives before we actually make a decision as to where they belong or whether or not we're going to put them forward for that year. It's not just our committee that does this. It also goes to the executive board, and it has to pass the executive board. And this is one of the situations that it almost has to be unanimous without even an abstaining vote for someone to pass through. So we all have to be in agreement. Luckily, I particularly think that this committee is one of the most friendliest, easygoing, enjoyable committees that anybody could ever belong to. So we normally talk things out and make a decision that is unanimous. We give out up to 3 awards a year, and it doesn't matter if it's, we could have 3 members of distinction, we could have 1 Hall of Fame, 1 Lifetime Achievement, 1 member of distinction, we could have 2 of something and 1 of another. As long as we keep it to 3, that works very well in with our place in the awards banquet, because we showcase our winners and our recipients of these awards at the awards showcase, awards banquet at USDF at the annual meeting.
And what is the process after that? Say I've nominated even 2 people, and by May the 1st, when the deadline is over, how do I know then the journey of that nomination, and when will I hear whether my nominee has been successful?
Okay, what we do is we do a phone conversation, usually in June. We go through all of the nominations. We very rarely say, oh, this is not good, you know, oh, we can't possibly use this. We hardly ever have said that. But what we do is we bring the ones to the top that we feel are most important and have the biggest impact. And so we go to the top for that. And then we send that along. We vote to send what we're going to send along to the executive board. And they make a decision and send it back to us. If there is someone that we say, you know, we don't have enough information, we don't feel like we can go forward, the USDF office usually contacts the person who nominates and says, you know, we're sorry, at this time we cannot go forward with this. Otherwise, we do keep, even if we don't give the award during that year, we keep them over and we keep relooking at them from year to year to year. There are some people that we feel that have been nominated that are still very influential and working within our sport. And so a few times we've kind of waited a couple of years just to see what happens, because you wouldn't want to give somebody a lifetime award, a lifetime achievement award twice. Well, I guess it could happen, but you know, we'd like to see the bulk of what they're doing closer to their retirement, so to speak, before we go ahead and say send them forward if we think they're going to do more.
Now, here's a question. You know, we always hope this wouldn't happen, but when you mentioned that nominees are rolled over after that May 1st deadline, so you could look at them in the future, what happens in the event of a nominee being deceased, Charlotte? And, you know, they may be a very worthy, and they may have had several nominees voting for them to be, say, a recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award or go into the Hall of Fame.
Oh, well, in 2016, we put Lillian Whitnack Rowe posthumously into the Hall of Fame. A lot of people have gone posthumously into the Hall of Fame. Whether or not they're living or dead doesn't make a real difference to that. Obviously, you know, we can't wait to see if they do more if they are deceased, but that doesn't really have that much of an impact. Of course, if you're given the award and you're still alive, we invite you to the awards. We ask you to speak and all that. And if not, then your closest family, we invite them to come and invite them to receive the plaques and give a little talk themselves.
And finally, then, a reminder of who is eligible to nominate of the membership.
Any member of USDF. It can be a GMO member or a participating member. It doesn't matter either way. As a matter of fact, as the way I understand it, the only one who cannot nominate is the chairman of the committee, which is myself. So there.
Okay. And a reminder that nomination deadline is May the 1st, as you said, Charlotte. Now is a good time to put forward your nominations, and those can be sent through to the USDF at hallofame@usdf.org. And of course, there is more information on the website. Is there anything else you would like our members to know, Charlotte, before you go?
No, only that if you miss the May 1st deadline, do not worry. We would happily accept the nomination. We'll just roll it over until the next year. So you can nominate anytime. And we also usually meet at least once during the USDF annual meeting. This year it's going to be in Salt Lake City. And I guarantee that if you come to one of our meetings, it'll be informative. We'll ask you to chime in on your memories of people. And we use it as a gathering of news, for that matter, and important things that people remember. And that also gets us set up for future projects. And also, please come and visit the USDF Hall of Fame at Lexington, Kentucky. I met a gal last week that told me, oh, I've just been to the horse park, and I saw California Chrome. I said, great. Did you go to USDF? She said, what? So, no, we have a very good office there, and they're very, very friendly. If sometimes they're even open during the weekends if there's a major show going on. Obviously, they'll be open during the regular times of a work day. But the Hall of Fame is very interesting to go through. There's a lot of interesting exhibits there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much indeed, Charlotte, Chair of the Historical Committee here at the USDF. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on the program and explain these awards to us, Charlotte. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And once again, a reminder that all nominations are due on or before May the 1st. And any nomination that's received after May the 1st deadline will be considered in the following year. And there'll be a link in the notes accompanying this episode to the nomination forms and further information about the USDF Service Awards. And finally, in our education segment, Dr. Laura Werner is here to explain what's new in the treatment of laminitis. And this excerpt was taken from the 2017 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. And we'll hear now about diagnosing and treating kissing spine.
I'm just going to talk about today about a few lameness and poor performance problems that we commonly see in our sport horses, and discuss some new technology or techniques that we have available to help us with impingement of dorsal spinous processes or kissing spine. So often the clinical signs that we can see in these horses are bucking, poor riding or jumping performance. Often we'll see these horses with a loss of their muscles over their top line or inability to develop muscles over their top line. Often we'll see where they're very painful on palpation on the back over the affected area. They might be resistant to flexion. So when we look at a horse and ask him to flex up his back and tighten his core muscles, we might see some resistance there. Oftentimes too as well, often just see a shifting or inconsistent hindland lameness. It's mostly present only when the horse is ridden, and so it's not present when the horse is just lunged or jogged in hand. So diagnosis for kissing spine can include obviously just the palpation and manipulation of the back. Often we will try to eliminate any other causes of lameness as the problem. You know, I'm a rider, so I do enjoy watching the horses under saddle too, because I think that gives a lot more perspective. And there's certainly some of these problems that you only see when the horse is in work or doing what job it should be doing. Nuclear scintigraphy or a bone scan we will do on some of these horses as well, where it's some of these intermittent or strange lamenesses, or they're not present all the time. So a bone scan is a good technique that we'll use, and oftentimes we will diagnose kissing spine on that bone scan. X-rays are probably the hallmark of our diagnosis, though. Oftentimes I mark on the radiographs on the horse's back. I'll mark along their horse's back where they're most painful on palpation, and then try to correlate those findings that we find on palpation of the back with what we find on X-rays, as well as try to mark where maybe the saddle seems to be pinching, that type of thing. Ultrasound also can demonstrate bony changes along the horse's back that may indicate there's a problem, or in the ligaments that are associated with the back as well. Sometimes we'll actually do diagnostic analgesia, or actually a nerve block, and so we'll infuse a local anesthetic agent around the affected area and see if the horse goes or changes better. This isn't as definitive as when you're, say, your veterinarian blocks the horse's leg, because there's several nerves and branches that come out, unfortunately, in this area. When these horses have kissing spine, sometimes they're muscle sore around there. It's not as black and white as, say, your veterinarian's blocking your horse for a foot abscess or something. And so often the results are a little bit confusing sometimes. So there's several different grades of kissing spine, and we do this based on the severity. So the grade one is just a narrowing of that space with some mild changes at the bone margins. Grade two, a complete loss of space with moderate changes at the bone margins. Three, severe increased changes. Four, where there's severe increased changes at the bone margins, actual change of the shape of the dorsal spinous processes, or complete overriding or overlapping of those dorsal spinous processes. Fortunately enough for you guys, I think most dressage horses have a lot stronger top line and back. You know, in my practice, I see these problems a lot more commonly being clinically affected in a thoroughbred cross. So, you know, oftentimes medical treatment of this condition will involve an injection, and usually we use the ultrasound to guide us where we're injecting the affected areas. So oftentimes we'll inject them in the ligament and surrounding tissue of those dorsal spinous processes, as well as the joints that are just below that. So, and we'll often use a combination of steroids and serapin and to inject, like I said, the ligament structures as well as the joints. And my rationale for treatment is often dependent on the horse's competition schedule, or if it's an FEI horse versus not, as to our drug withdrawal times that we do have available. Shockwave therapy is another great treatment as well, and it will help with the bony abnormalities, but it also helps with the pain involved that we see in the surrounding muscle. Acupuncture or other alternative therapies like this are also very commonly used. Mesotherapy, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that. It's a technique that involves somewhat of the acupuncture points in the back as well as the nerves. And it's a good technique that will help with pain in these guys, which is a lot of times, you know, what we see is these horses' reaction to that pain. Bisphosphonates, I'm sure you guys have heard of those, which are more commonly, you've heard of the term, probably the medications Tildren or Osfos. And those are, were shown in a clinical study to have improvement in horses and back pain up to 120 days after administration. So that's a good option available for us. Again, drug withdrawal times could be affected, especially with FEI. Those medications will carry a 28-day day withdrawal time, as well as just non-steroidals and muscle relaxants. So I've experienced back pain. I'm sure a lot of you guys have. We're all athletes as well, too. And we know a lot of these, the treatment of this sort of involves a multimodal therapy. And so I will use non-steroidals and muscle relaxants, not just alone, but in combination with these other therapies, because I feel it's important sometimes to just get these horses over that painful cycle so they can return back to their job and they're not so sour or thinking that it's going to be a problem when, in fact, we are treating the actual problem. Also, physical therapy and rehabilitation, I think, are extremely important, and I'll get into that a little bit later. As well as saddle fit, I think, is extremely important in these horses. If the saddle does not fit, it will continue to cause a problem with these horses if it's around the affected area of the kissing spine. So having a good saddle fitter or a saddle that's properly fit to the horse is important, you know, for all horses, but especially for any horse that is affected with kissing spine. So there used to be a surgical treatment, actually, and it involved actual removal of the affected kissing spine. So that was the surgery that was performed, and it's been around for a long time. I wasn't a huge proponent of it. I don't do a lot of them because sometimes these horses would end up more painful afterward than to start with, because you'd have a large surgical scar or area right under the saddle. And so would try to manage my cases medically as much as I could, because this old technique, unfortunately, we have wasn't a good solution for these type of horses that need to perform and have a saddle sit over that affected area that you would perform the surgery in. So recently a newer surgical approach has been reported. This can be performed in the standing horse, so that's another benefit, that the horses do not have to undergo general anesthesia for this technique, where actually the ligaments between those affected dorsal spinous processes are cut. And it's done with a minimally invasive approach, and reportedly 3 to 8 sites are performed. So basically, the affected spinous processes are identified with a spinal needle in this place, and we do obviously use radiographic guidance in the horses. And these horses, like I said, are standing and just sedated, and then local anesthesia or local nerve block area has been performed in this area. And then just basically small incisions are made through the skin, just lateral to midline at the affected sites. And then basically scissors are taken to bluntly dissect through the tissue and cut that affected ligament. And sometimes this is a little bit more difficult in the ones that are really overriding or overlapping, but it can be performed. And after surgery, there's very small incisions at each affected site. And so cosmetically performing, it's a lot better result than the previous surgical technique. There's much less minimal postoperative complications because, you know, where they would take out the spinous processes before would involve a large incision. These are just small incisions. And so we will start these horses right away, almost on hand walking and turnout, because, and this is the important part of the surgery, much like rehab, that the best surgical results are in these horses that are rehabbed properly afterward. So we start them working pretty much right away with that Pessoa lunging system. And what that does is have the horse utilize its core and round up its back. And what we've shown with that releasing of that ligament is actually those interspinous spaces will increase after we cut that ligament. So that's what we're going for, okay? But again, where just the surgery alone was performed and the horses are not rehabbed afterward, it doesn't work. So this is a key component to that. And it's just much like us. I mean, I had a bad back injury several years ago. You know, I think, like I said, us as riders, I think it's just as important for us to be physically strong and have our core. Because I know when my back was hurting, the more core exercises I did, the better I felt. And so this is a very critical part of the whole process. Again, check that saddle fit, and then like any ancillary therapies, just to get that horse over that painful experience of associating whatever riding or whatever, you know, saddle is causing that pain. So it's not an instant fix. This is going to be a few month process.
And our thanks again to Dr. Laura Werner for this excerpt that was taken from the 2017 Adequan USDF Annual Convention entitled What's New in the Treatment of Lameness. And finally, before we go, we have a reminder to USDF dressage judges, L graduates, and those enrolled in the L education program. It's easy to stay up to date on what's being taught in the L program now, where you can visit the website where you can access all of the current L education program material for only $15 a year. The website includes exclusive biomechanics, freestyle, and practice test videos. This website is restricted to those USDF members who are licensed USCF dressage judges, L graduates with distinction, and those enrolled in the L education program. And you can find much more information, as I said, by going to the website and visiting the L education page at usdf.org. And that's our show for this week. Be sure to follow the USDF's official pages on social media at Facebook and Twitter to find out when the next episode is available. Of course, when you're on the website, don't forget to check out the eTrack pages where you can find much more educational information and resources. If you listen to this show on the website, you can also download it to any podcast player. It's available to anyone, whether you're a member or not, on any podcast app such as iTunes. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time for another episode of the USDF's official podcast. Until then, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.